Resilience is such a loaded word. I'll give you an example from outside of it to explain why I say this. My kids. Like all parents, I want them to be resilient humans. I want them to be able to face adversity with their chins up, to not shy away from hard things, but I also want them to be self-aware enough to be kind to others and to themselves when they need to be. Not too hard on themselves, but not too easy. Goldilocks level. They play rugby, my kids. They've played it from a very young age, back from when it was all about fun and inclusivity, with nobody keeping score, well, nobody except for all of the kids, to where my eldest is now, where things are starting to get a bit more serious. That eldest has a new coach. He's phenomenal. Ex-Wallaby player, super experienced coach. I love watching him coach. Last week at training, after a bunch of kids had come off the field nursing bumps and bruises, sometimes with some tears, coach gave a bit of a talk after training. "There's a difference between hurt and injured," he said. "We want to avoid injury, but hurt, that's part of the game. In fact, if you finish a game and you're not hurting, you probably didn't play hard enough." Now, I know that some of you might think, "Ugh, so much toxic masculinity." Maybe. I think about that too. Like, where is the line between suck it up and power through and put aside how you're feeling and being sensibly resilient? And that's why I say resilience is such a loaded word. The boomers think that the millennials are not resilient enough, and the millennials look at the boomers and think, "I'm not putting up with that shit." And us Gen X's are somewhere in the middle trying to keep the peace. I'll tell you this about the rugby though. In 8 years of watching junior rugby, I've never seen a single coach tell a kid to toughen up, man up, or even to stop crying. There's always concern. How are you feeling? Can you walk? Can you bend it? No, don't bend it that way. There's a hug if it's needed, or a bag of ice, a lolly. And then usually it's have a rest, and when you feel ready, then get back out there and give them hell, because your team needs you. So back to Coach Ben and hurt versus injured. He said to the team, "This is what we train you for, to make your bodies resilient enough so that you can put up with the hurt without getting injured." What he doesn't say explicitly is that we're also building emotional resilience, not toughness, because tough is tough until it breaks. But resilience bounces back. And they'll need that, because hard knocks are baked into the game. Rugby is a blood sport after all. And according to Jeff Wilson, our guest for this episode, something else that is a blood sport is veterinary science. And Jeff is intimately familiar with resilience. Veterinarian down to the core, Dr. Jeff Wilson lives a vast and varied life split between being a family man, a veterinarian, practice owner, and adventurer. And not a let's take the 4x4 out to the beach this weekend and rough it on a blow-up mattress while the beers chill in the esky type of adventurer. Much more of a polar explorer, world record breaker, kite surf across an ocean type of adventurer in the spirit of Shackleton and Scott. Highlights of Jeff's expeditionist career include the longest solo unsupported polar journey in human history, the fastest unsupported crossing of Greenland, the fastest solo unsupported crossing of Antarctica, the first to cross the Torres Strait by kiteboard, the first and only wind-assisted crossing of the Sahara Desert, and the first wind-powered crossing of the Simpson Desert in Australia. Jeff's newest adventure, Project Zero, is a net zero docuseries documenting a voyage that explores some of the world's most isolated and vulnerable environments, and the visible impact of global warming on those landscapes, and engaging with the world's leading climate scientists, advocates, and initiatives. But where Jeff shows true courage and true resilience is when he's back in Australia, facing anal glands, and itchy dogs, and fluted cats, and upset clients, and round two of a growing veterinary team with his new group of vet practices, VetLove. In this conversation, Jeff takes us on a journey through the peaks and troughs of his own experiences, shedding light on the dangers of pushing ourselves too far and the pitfalls of toxic resilience versus utilizing passion, purpose, and persistence to help shape true resilience. Jeff helps us to explore where things like vulnerability, optimism, and a service mindset fits in with toughness, and he opens up about a unique program at VetLove designed to cultivate unicorns, exceptional vets who thrive under the weight of demanding expectations, plus trying to find that delicate balance of nurturing growth without breaking spirits. Now, before we set sail with Jeff, I just wanted to share some news about our clinical podcasts. We get a lot of questions about CPD points. Can I claim points for listening to the clinical podcasts? Yes, you can. In most places, most states and countries will allow unstructured or unassessed CE points for podcast listening. So just write down how much you listen. That used to be my answer. But now, as of about a month or so ago, the answer is absolutely yes. Assessed points, even in the US, because we have race approval for a bunch of our episodes, and we're working on the rest. So now you can listen at your leisure, on your way to work, or while you're trying to drown out the noise of kids, and then later, you can go to the space where we keep our show notes, click a link that will take you to a quiz, pass the quiz, the answers are all in the show notes, and get an official race-approved CE certificate emailed to you as a record of how smart you're becoming. It's that simple. Join our community of VetVault nerds at vvn.supercast.com or email us at info@thevetvault.com to find out about our practice subscriptions. Oh, and then one more last little technical thing about this episode and audio quality. I managed to catch Jeff for this interview somewhere between the South Pole and his next consult. So we are recording this with Jeff literally in the vet clinic. I don't know if you know this, but vet clinics do not have the best audio acoustics, and there's a fair bit of background noise. So when you listen to this, you'll notice for the first 9 minutes or so of the conversation, I put up with Jeff's really bad acoustics, and then I politely asked him to move to a better room. So at about 9 minutes, the sound gets heaps better. I kept the first 9 minutes in there because the content is just so good. So I apologize for less than perfect audio, but you can hear what he says and you have to hear it. Okay, let's get started with Dr. Jeff Wilson. So excited for this chat.
So good to be here. It's been a long time coming.
I know. I did some prep for you and Googled you, and that's your life is a big rabbit hole. Like, you could spend ages reading about what Jeff's been up to, but I think I've got a good one. We'll start at the normal first question. Bad decisions lead to good stories. Do you agree? And if you do, do you have any stories that support that statement? And I think you probably would have a lot of bad decision good stories.
Oh, yeah. I mean, obviously, as we get older, we're trying to make less bad decisions, because in the wellness field, bad decisions can lead to you not coming home or you come home in a bag. On this last journey, I think the bad decision was trying to sail the Southern Ocean in a tiny little seal sailboat with family on board. You know, we had a moment there in the Southern Ocean, 1,000 kilometers from the nearest ship that would help, and the ocean just went crazy, 72 knots, sort of matching wind, 15 minute seas, three different swell directions on top of each other, and just getting thrown around like a cork. And all four of us dressed and are ready for the boat to break up. And I entered life raft, and you're just thinking, what the hell? Why did I decide to do this? But yeah, it's certainly a good story. But I'm trying to minimize the good stories in the last quarter of my life.
Good stories, but stories that don't involve near-death experiences.
Absolutely. And a drinking story or something less dramatic.
Jeff, if we had recorded this podcast before you went on that trip and you said to me, I'm going to sail the South Seas on a small little boat, I think I would have told you, Jeff, that sounds like a bad decision, mate.
Absolutely. I mean, and in front of your boat feels big until you get into a real sea, and then you feel like an ant amongst giants. It's very, very humbling.
Yeah. So you said a question there when you told that story. You said when you were caught in the middle of all of that, you thought to yourself, why am I doing this? And I want to start the front end of this whole conversation with, why do you do all the stuff that you do?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny because, I mean, I think a lot of people feel for my poor wife, Sarah. She's been a very patient girl. But I think if this had been a midlife crisis, and I've suddenly gone crazy and become a polar explorer on top of, you know, being a veterinary surgeon, you kind of feel it sorry for her, because that's, you know, some sort of reality to something, you know, a life misplaced. But it's something that I've done really on my greatest adventure. I can remember sort of the age of 5. You know, when I met Sarah, I was disappearing into the wilderness very regularly. even when we were dating and then early marriage, there was a period, obviously, knocking down and learning the bat tray and then building our first practice group, young kids on the ground, you know, all of that sort of period as a dad, where you're not bringing it frequently, but it's always been part of my DNA. So, you know, my family feel like I was born 100 years too late. I would have been, you know, in the heroic age of Shackleton and Mawson Scott type personality. And I really do relate to those men and the challenges they had assimilating into normal society. But I really love the balance I've got now. It's taken a long time, but to get the balance between passionate about work, bringing the polar survival sort of resilience development stuff back into veterinary science. For a long time, we built a firewall between the two because I really felt they didn't help each other. But with the challenges that young vets feel today and young people feel today, the resilience development stuff that we use in the field is so applicable. So for the first time, I feel like it's hand in gloves and this odd lifestyle is starting to work. But it's taken 53 years to get that met.
So you say that you're using the polar or the adventuring, bringing it into vet work. Is that through resilient training or how are you fitting the two together?
Well, Mel Klugentrainer, my managing director, is a super clever lady. And before the last polar journey, which is 2019-2020, she came to me and said, listen, why do you not talk to our people about all the stuff that you're sharing with corporates in terms of resilience development, dream big, plan well, finding passion in what you're doing, all of that stuff. So you never talk to our people. And I kind of said, well, it's a bit like a prophet is not a prophet in his hometown. You're just Jeff Wilson, you know. You're probably not going to be taken seriously by the people that you work with. They've seen you doing anal glands and getting mud and love on your face. So they don't see you as it's polar or explorer. Whereas when I've sat in front of a bunch of accounts in Sydney or, you know, corporate gig at Perth, the mining community, they see you as this incredible driven polar explorer, and you have authority to talk about resilience because of the survival situations and push through. But Mel said, listen, I think, you know, the time is now. And then when I got back from that to then, he would step within a month into COVID. And during that COVID era, I started to talk to our own people about resilience development, about digging deep. Yeah, how do we remain passionate and enjoy what we're doing 30 years into the veterinary career? And we're starting to see a massive shift in teams and our staff and our rotation rates. And that was through the genius of Mel, just going, hey, you have to bring the stuff back. And me being brave enough, I think, to be open and vulnerable in front of people that I work with daily. That's always, it's easier to be open and vulnerable to people you're not going to see again. But when you're working with them daily and you're peeling off your layers and exposing your heart and your fears, your wants, that's more difficult with your own people. But it has been amazing to a point now to be running a program called Center for Vet. It's just four graduates coming straight out of uni. They join the Vet Love Set for Vet program, and the pool masters are put through 24-hour sailing, they put through climbing through 40-meter vertical tunnels, they put through ice baths, they put through breath holding, free diving, all of this horrendous stuff to just start moving their tap out point. Because my goal is to have a graduate. Their tap out point is so far out of a consulting room, it's so far out of the surgery that, and when they have a fat which they bleed into death on the table, they're not going into panic and their brain is, you know, shutting down. They're not going back into that reptilian brain because they dangled off a rope in a terrifying spider-filled black hole at Mount France. You know, connected to me in there, and I'm teaching them how to think through panic, how to breathe properly and calm things down to a point where when that stage is going horribly wrong, they're just thinking clearly, I got this, I got confidence. It's amazing to see it start to really affect these young ones to a point where our resilience program last year started with six, and we've got three of that six that I would say are unicorns. So they're best, that are going to be exceptional at what they do and do it for a lifetime because they're loving it, they're passionate, their KPIs are off the chart, they're communicating well, they're fearless, and I really do think it's a result of bringing this stuff into the vet world.
What you discussed there, what you do with your team, I've got a couple of questions, and it's just, I didn't plan on discussing this at all, but immediately, are you getting buy-in from that? Are the team saying, wow, this is awesome, let's do this?
Yeah, it's tricky because it's almost like they feel like these new grads are the spoiled kids on the block because they've not had this level of attention. You know, we've talked about resilience development, but we've never done it in practicality. But the cost of the program is pretty hefty for us. So put all of the staff through, you know, overnight sailing, a 24-hour pipe. We've developed a thing called the Vet Love Tenacity Score, which these poor buggers have to hold a brick outstretched into a deep squat to failure. And then they sprint up my driveway, which is this horrible cement driveway with the numbers. Every crack is numbered. And at the beginning of the program, we see their tap out point, bottom third. And then they're into an ice bar for as long as they can handle it. When we aggregate those scores, they get a Vet Love Tenacity score, and that's an aggregate of a squat, a sprint up a hill with a brick, and then an ice bar. And working with them for 6 months, and we retest that, and usually we have to pull them out of the ice bar before they get hypothermia.
So the reason I ask is, how do you structure this? Because it's such a cool idea, and I find that when you talk to veterinary leaders, they often are very good ideas that people come up with. But getting the team to say yes to it is sometimes, I mean, the stuff you're describing, I can see the benefit, but it's not like, hey, let's go to the movies or let's go to the pub. They're hard things. How do you get that? Is it part of the requirement that if you work for VetLove, you're going to have to go through the tenacity thing, or is it a voluntary thing?
But no, it's a voluntary thing to get into the program. And we do pay them a bonus during 5th year. So the young ones who sign up, the idea is most of our grads arrive exhausted. They've been working a job, studying, they've just done exams. They come in and they're set for failure because they're tired, they're stressed. They're going to make a mistake and that's going to affect confidence. So we listen, here's a 10 grand bonus, go and relax, have a holiday. We'll see you the 1st of February, but we're going to go hard. So they have the whole of January, December, January off. They should come in ready to party. The issue we have is because it's a tenacity development program, you'd think it would attract the very best of the graduates because of the bonus, but they look at the bonus and don't believe it. They're like, this is too good to be true. What am I?
You know, or maybe it's like, well, how shit is this job that they have to give me $10,000 just to,
I'm like, I'm scratching my head going, holy crap. They either don't believe it or they think it's some sort of catch. So maybe we need to reduce it to a $1,000 bonus. But once they're in, I think they realize we've got myself on surgical sort of mentorship, Chris Lazowski, surgical mentorship, Ash Henniker on medical coaching, Karina Jurz on medical coaching. We have a communication specialist come and talk to them. Here we're tackling it from all areas. But the three big fears that we're finding is, one, they're told all the way through uni that the job's going to suck. Like from the freaking podium. Like I'm furious at the academics because we've spent 50 years training the wrong people. We're picking that top 1% who are on the spectrum generally with very low EQ for a blood sport. So we're training the wrong effing people. And then they tell them the job's going to suck. You're going to self-harm. You're not going to earn money. You're going to work 100-hour week and get exhausted. And they're all lies. So we can show them, if they value their time and build properly, 38-hour week, we can get you to triple-figure income very quickly. And then if we can give you equity, dividends, you know, we can times that by 3. So you'll be doing as well as the dentists, doing something that you love, making a difference. You're not looking in the same orifice for your whole career. It just drives me crazy that we're fighting this thing where we just brought our next group of 6 graduates in 2 weeks ago, and I got on the podium in front of them and just said, hey, this is a really intimate group. This is what we're trying to do. You're working the best job in the world. I can teach you how to communicate well, how to eat well, sleep well, balance your life. You've got to have interests outside veterinary science. Do not come to veterinary science for happiness. This is not what veterinary science is for. You're a servant. It's a service industry. You're here to serve. You come in with a service attitude and understand that you are here to take pain away from animals that cannot speak for themselves. If you've got that attitude, then you are going to be passionate and you'll be as fired up as me for this job in 34 years. When they came out of that session, there was a full day. The poor buggers were thrown into ice baths. You know, it's a really awkward, uncomfortable day for them. At the end of it, they were in shock. And I said, hey, how was that? And they said, you know, that's the first time we've ever heard anyone speak life over this industry. And I'm like, my whole mantra for this year is vet is life. It is. We have to speak positive about our industry. Drug reps come in dragging their feet. Our team leaders are dragging their feet. You talk to the reps, and let's say 3 out of 4 clinics they go into, we'll have a lead veterinarian who's, you know, down in the dumps about the industry. And we've got young vets coming out fearful of the job they're stepping into, because for 5 years of uni, they've been told from the podium that the industry sucks. So we have done this to ourselves by A, allowing the academics to pick intelligence, not EQ and mental toughness. None of these kids would survive uptake into the paramedic field. We need to apply the same metrics that they're using. You know, that the kids that have done other things in their life or played football or done team sports make incredible veterinarians. The ones that have struggled to get the score and had to do a second course, they're the ones we pick for the resilience program. 6 out of 6 of the kids in the resilience program have done another course before they get into vet. So I know that they want this. They're hungry for it. They're going to be brand. You know, I know I'm rambling a little bit here, but my key passion is if we can pick the right people and tell them vet is life, don't tell them vet is death.
Yeah.
Then we create incredible veterinarians that stay in the industry. And you and I are working harder than we thought we would at this age because we've lost so many good vets. Mm. They've either been aligned with a vet that's negative, or they've had someone speak poison over it and it's killed their passion and they've left.
Wow, you've opened up so many doors for conversations, Jeff. Firstly, I just want to ask quickly, so with the picking of the wrong people, and I've heard that said before, so what do the paramedics do? What metrics do they apply for selection? I've never heard of that before.
We need, I think, if you look at the intelligence pyramid, we're picking top 1%. And the only school I know of that is actually doing a very simple questionnaire to try and pick the mid-band is Wagga. Wagga, I might have the stats wrong, but I think dropped their 2-year dropout rate from 50% to 10% by doing 30 questions. And all that's trying to do is identify that mid-band. It's easy for the universities to go, okay, let's just make it an intelligence bar. Everybody wants to do that. But what we're doing is picking the kids that have not had time to go and learn communication skills, develop emotional intelligence. You know, we're picking the ones that have had terrible experiences in life, so they're damaged and they turn to animals, so they hate people. And we're trying to get them to deal with 5 people per animal. So, you know, just picking those people that are emotionally traumatized from some event in their life and they're driven to animals because they hate people. That's the wrong person for a veterinarian. Like we need people that have that threefold love. They love the animal, they love the client, they love their team. Yeah, when we get those in a team, then there's no problem with passion, there's no problem with positivity. Problem is we're trying to herd this damaged flock and get them to understand that, hey, I know people are annoying, but there's 5 people for every animal. You need to learn how to deal with them. And if we're communicating well, the financial discussion doesn't even come up because you've communicated how valuable that animal is to the family unit. And it's worth $1,500 for a dental or whatever it is that we're struggling. That when you've got someone who is on the spectrum somewhere, they're really struggling to communicate. Everything's stressful. They love bits of the job because they're good at it. But the things that cause stress start pushing them out of industry. And if we can select from that intelligence pyramid, we don't need geniuses. You know, what we're doing as vets, I think we like to think we're geniuses, but mid-band with high EQ is way more valuable. And then we don't have that skills gap with somebody who's highly intelligent but can't get a capture in, or highly intelligent and finds the fact which spay the most stressful thing in their life. Or an animal dies on their watch and they take it so personally that they want to go home and self-harm. That's not on them. That's on us and the educators picking the wrong person, you know, the paramedic kind of psych eval, just applying that to what we're doing on the intake would fix a lot of our problems industry-wide. So even the resilience program that we're doing, it's a little too late. You know, once you've committed 5 years of your life and then you realize this is different to what I expected. There's a lot more people involved. There's a lot more finesse and communication required. I'm not a good communicator. I don't like people. You know, no matter how much resilience I can teach that person, it's still going to be stressful for them dealing with the general public. And most of the self-harm I've seen along the way, and touch wood, we've never had anyone within the vet love team self-harm, has come from trauma pre-vet school. They carried that with them, thinking that veterinary science would make them happy. And I recently had a young graduate come home for dinner, and her comment was, "I really hope veterinary science makes me happy." And I got so passionate and blown up about it that Sarah had to put a hand on my arm and go, "Hey, give the poor girl a break." I'm like, "Veterinary science is not here to fucking make you happy. It is not here to make you happy. You're a servant. You are coming in with the wrong attitude. And if you come in looking for happiness within veterinary science, you're going to last 5 minutes. You have to see your role as the maker of magic. You're here to reduce pain, to bring health, to work with the family unit, make sure that animal is treated fairly. You know, when you come at it from service mindset, you're here to serve, then you find happiness through it. But if you're coming here to get happiness, then you're in the wrong trade. And getting that understanding, it's too late when they've done 5 years to hear that. They need to hear it pre-intake, first year, second year, starting to get them into a service mindset before they get out.
And the reality of what you're describing there, of what the job involves, of it is a giving job, and it is hard, because I feel sometimes like we, and I think I'll probably put myself for the first 5 to 10 years in that group of going, why is this job not make this job's freaking hard? When is it going to get easier? And it's taken a long time to realize, no, it doesn't actually. Like, some of the technical stuff gets easier, but a lot of it is still hard. But hard doesn't mean bad necessarily.
No, and I think understanding, you know, when I'm talking to a room of veterinarians and describing the hardship of surviving a polar storm where you're solo, you're in a tent, and you're getting decreasingly optimistic forecasts from your weather guys, like, this is a savage storm coming, buckle in, build a wall, it's going to be 3 or 4 days of hell for you. And then the next forecast 12 hours later is it's downgraded, you've now got a polar hurricane crossing the Antarctic Ocean, it's going to slam in your position within 6 hours, this may not be a survivable event. And then you're forced to make the phone call home and say, "Listen, Sarah, this is a really bad situation. I may not be able to communicate during the worst of the storm. If the tent fails, my survival time is going to be less than 4 hours." You know, you're describing all of that and then referencing back, you know, having survived that sort of storm, you think that the veterinary world would have nothing to challenge you. But a day where you've got back-to-back surgeries, you've got consults in the morning, you know, a couple of staff issues to sort out, there's a bit of political dynamics within the hospital, and then you go out and you're 3 consults behind in the afternoon session, those sort of days can be equally as tough. So for vets to hear that and go, okay, you've got this polar explorer saying, you know, these are really tough things, but the veterinary environment will throw similar kind of stress load on the human frame, it just allows you to go, hey, it's absolutely fine to have days where you feel a bit pushed, but it's how you respond to that that matters. You know, do you get stressed and start getting the knives out and stabbing your team, or do you go at the back and practice what we taught you in the ice bar? You go and box breathe, you get your pulse rate down, and maybe decrease some load. Say, listen, I'm going to let these people know to go and get a coffee and come back, or I'm going to admit an animal. Let's try and reduce some load before we blow a gasket, recognizing when your system is at a pressure point. And that being okay, like, it's absolutely fine to say, hey, I'm a little cooked here, but we tend to feel like we've got to keep this stiff upper lip, and that can be our own undoing. So I think recognizing that the veterinary environment is tough, but it's the best job in the world. It absolutely is. We've got to believe that as leaders. I look at, you know, I spoke to a vet yesterday who used to work for us, and she had quite a lot of mental instability, and we recognized that that was getting worse over time. So she self-elected herself out, went work elsewhere, probably a less nurturing environment. And just over a week ago, she tried to OD and kill herself. Now, it's really topical for me, understanding, okay, what is it? All of that stuff that she's going through didn't come from veterinary science. That came from it predates the veterinary course. She's a brilliant veterinarian. There's a bit like, almost like body dysmorphia, where you've got someone who is prime weight, but they see themselves as either overweight or underweight. And everyone's saying, hey, you're prime weight. You're fine. You're doing well. I think what happens with a lot of these younger vets is that they see themselves as being inept or unable to cope. And everyone around them is looking at them going, hey, you're doing a great job. Your clients love you. The animal outcomes you're getting are superb. How do we get you to believe in yourself? And in this particular vet's case, it's just not possible for her to see how good she is. She'd be one of the best vets I've ever worked with, and yet she's trying to end her life. And you just go, okay, you probably were the wrong personality type for this blood sport. You know, on any given day, we've got shit, piss and blood flying around the room and things dying and a lot of passion. You've got to love the fight. Like, you've got to love being in there. It's a phenomenal quote. You'd know the quote. You know, give me an hour in the arena with blood, sweat, mud all over me. I'd rather an hour of that than a lifetime of the ordinary. You know, you've really got to love that fight. I think that's what we're getting across to these young ones, going, hey, nothing's perfect. Absolutely. There's no job on the planet that's perfect. But if we can see the gold in the rock, you know, you're looking at this rock face of veterinary science and just looking for the seams of gold that crucially you've fixed, and the dog's in the park running madly 3 months later, or the litter of kittens that you've brought into the world, or if you're in a large animal practice, you've got this foal running around that you were involved in bringing into the world. You've got to see those bits of gold, and that undoes all of the fatigue and the long days. But also in with that, teaching them ways to recognize stress, recognize when, you know, I call a real high producing vets Maseratis. They run at really high revs, and we have to put them on the blocks, let them cool down for a while, and then put them back in again. You know, we've got some diesel chug chugs like me who are not going to create brilliance in medically, but I can fix just about anything. And if I don't know what to do, I'll find someone smarter like you talk to.
No, that is literally my superpower, is I just know lots of smart people.
chug, another diesel chug. So we're never going to blow up. But you need that mix in the team. But recognizing that it's okay to go, hey, I really think you're in danger of blowing up. Let's get you off the front line for a little bit. That human dynamic, making it okay to be vulnerable. You know, we changed a lot of the way that we communicate from Expedition now on the back of Brené Brown stuff. On vulnerability, I don't know if you've read any of that, but there'll be people listening here who are very familiar with Brené Brown's work on vulnerable language. And that works twofold. One, in consult room, to create bond with clients very quickly. Being a little vulnerable is pure gold. But from Expedition, it used to be that I would ring back to home base to check in. Hey, I've made this amount of miles today. This is my position, code green, everything going forward. I'm fine. Whereas in the tent, I was decompensating and wondering why I was there. You know, had aches and strains that were making me feel like I wasn't going to get to the objective we've set. On the longest journey, we really worked on me being open and vulnerable from day one. And for the first 17 days, I was in tears in the tent every night, just weeping to Sarah. And back home, she's thinking, mate, what the hell is wrong with this guy? He's not even going to make it to the pole of inaccessibility. But it was when I got home and looked at the windshield chart, I was operating in minus 88 to minus 92 below zero Celsius windshield. So air temperatures of minus 40 to minus 50, but going upwind in 25 to 30 knots. So
a little bit of crying is totally acceptable.
So when you see that, you're like, I feel a bit better about crying. And the minute we got to the pole of inaccessibility, I was crosswind downwind. and everything changes. So really getting across to our vets that it's not always going to be upwind. That it might be tough now, but you'll develop better skills, you'll learn to communicate better, you'll develop a bit of resilience, a bit of hardiness. If it feels really challenging now, that doesn't mean that you're not going to make an exceptional veterinarian. It doesn't mean that you're not going to keep your passion for it. Understanding that, you know, if a human body can deal with 17 days straight in excruciating conditions, as long as you're being vulnerable and offloading that little bit at the end of the day, you've got a network around you of healthy support. There's nothing that you can't work your way through. And I think this is the exciting thing about bringing the polar stuff into the veterinary game. It really has given us a lot of help dealing with the crisis of the modern day veterinary era.
I wanted to give you a quick update on our specialist support space. If you haven't come across it before, we created a space where you can interact with a group of specialists to give you case support on those tricky case conundrums that you face in everyday practice. The space is housed on the same app where our subscribers get their show notes, which is a super nifty tool where you can upload photos or videos or even chat live to the specialist if the case requires it. The idea with this is that you have a direct, guilt-free line of communication with somebody who can help you out with those cases that you can't refer or you don't want to refer, but you just need a little bit of extra brain power to help you make decisions or check your thinking. We started off the space with support in medicine and emergency and critical care, but in the last month, we added support in dermatology, veterinary oncology, as well as support specifically for those tricky diabetic cases. Our subscribers will have listened to the episode with Dr. Linda Fleeman on using basal insulin in your patients for a complete paradigm shift in how you manage your diabetic patients. But this has led to a lot of questions for Dr. Linda, so we decided to get her on the space so she can answer your questions directly. It is a paid space, but we've kept it as affordable as possible at about $15 a month. We can ask as many questions as you want and expect a same-day turnaround time. We've put the link for the space in the show description wherever you're listening to this. So if you feel like you can use a little bit of extra help, go and check it out today. I want to come back to how that's the uptake on that and whether it's working. But just a couple of things I want to circle back to. It's so interesting that you compare that low that you're having in the tent at night, having to call home and say, look, I might not survive the storm. I can't imagine anything harder than that. But that you acknowledge that a bad day at a vet clinic is also bad. Like it's not, because coming into this conversation, I was half expecting that you'd be like, well, I've survived all this other stuff and I can run through a desert and I can do all these crazy things. So a day at the vet clinic is nothing. Like it's the zero stress. It's easy. But I love that you say, no, it is still hard. I have another friend who was on the podcast once, Dr. Gareth Steele, who is he's a vet, but then he actually is a military man as well, to the point of where he actually did active service in Afghanistan and all that sort of stuff. He told me once, he said that working in a non-supportive vet clinic in the wrong kind of environment is harder for him than being in active duty and being shot at in a war zone. Mentally, it's harder. Because he's not getting the support and he finds it more stressful at times. He says at least when he's being shot at, he has a team. They know exactly what to do. There's support. There's a structure that makes that achievable, which I found totally fascinating.
I think it's hard too, because if you're a vet out there listening and you're in that horrible state where you're the only guy, and we looked at three clinics last week for acquisition and they were all the same. It was an older guy or girl who worked, say 40 years in their clinic, they've struggled to find an associate. They're one vet doing a $2 million turnover, which is, we all know, to do that, you're working 100-hour week. You're running ragged. So, and then they've got to the end of their tether with it and put the practice on the market. But we look at it and go, well, we can't sustain that profitability with the modern vet. They're going to work a 38-hour week. So we need to put three vets in to do the work that you've been doing one. That's going to hammer the bottom line and we can't acquire the practice. So, you know, for that person, they're feeling completely isolated. They can't find an associate. They don't have the management skills to work out an exit strategy other than I'm just going to put it on the market, I'm done. And I just got sad looking at the figures because you can kind of see the human pain behind it. And I don't really have a solution for that, but all I can do is deal on our little corner of the pond. And Glenn Richards is a good mate of mine. And years ago when we were trying to get a Bond Uni veterinary course up, my theory was, listen, the educators aren't listening to us. I can't even get, I send emails to every single year, say, let me talk to your first and second years about passion, purpose, persistence, the three tenets of resilient development early. Let me tell them what a phenomenal job this is. And if anybody talks to you from the podium about how crap it is, tell them to F off. We need to get them out of the educators. They need to be gone. If you do not like veterinary science, what the frick are you teaching our kids for? That's how militant we need to be. And the only way I could see that happening was to go to Bond and say, listen, we need a separate course where it's all about high EQ. It's all about team sport. You know, picking people that are resilient from the get-go. Glenn came to me and said, listen, Jeff, you're going to exhaust yourself. You can't fix the industry, and nor do you need to. You just need to fix your little corner of the pond. And I went home and shared with Sarah Glenn's conversation, and I was like, yeah, I do feel like I'm exhausting myself trying to fix an industry-wide problem that's taken 50 years selecting the wrong people to get this way. I can't do it. So we kind of pulled out of that conversation with Bond and just said, okay, well, listen, let's just do a resilience program internally and just try and protect our young vets so that they wake up every morning with excitement. Like, you want them to wake up and put their boots on and go, I'm in the best job in the world. I get to affect animals. And I work on every vet having an image across the five horizons behind them of all the animals that they fixed during their career, whether it's 1 year career or a 30 year career. There's almost like the animals walking under the ark, walking across the horizons behind them, so that they can really measure the effect they're having on families, on Australian communities. You know, we saw in COVID how important these animals became for people that were suffering or had loss. That big rush of people grabbing puppies because they had time, and even changing the way they work, because when COVID was over, they didn't want to lose that time with their animals. You know, you've become more than just a vet for the family. You're almost counselor and priest at the same time, and that does put a lot more pressure on our younger vets. But if they approach it with that service mindset and are excited to put their boots on every day, then it's fun.
When I chat to vets who are sick of it, and as I said, I've been there, but who go, I don't know if I can do this anymore. I feel like a lot of the problem comes down to the interactions with clients. So they are passionate about the animals. They're like, I want to fix animals. I love it. I love that aspect. But then I get to work and I get a lot of friction from the humans around the animals. So, and they give me a hard time because I just want to do my job well. But people are whingy, they're needy, they're complaining. Two questions. Have you experienced the change in your career, Jeff, in that sense? Like, are people harder work now than they were when you became a vet? And B, how do you talk to your team about that aspect of the, because that's the sort of hard that people, and I appreciate there's a lot of emotion, and I think most vets realize that there is a human skill side to it. But then what exhausts them is people who just push too hard. Their perception from a lot of vets is there are clients who are, they're not part of the team. They're in an antagonistic fashion. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we've seen is, you know, the animal used to be in the paddock, and then it's on the veranda, then it's in the lounge, now it's in bed with people. So their demands for quality medicine and surgery have gone up. Their demands for professional, educated communication have gone up. They're watching medical shows. So, you know, before, if we spoke to someone about removing a lump or showed them photos of that lump coming off, they'd vomit in the corner. They now want to be involved in the process. So you can see that as they're being more demanding, more difficult, or you can go, wow, these guys are so passionate. I get to do vet science at a high level. I get to get the toys now. I can do endoscope. I can do ultrasound. I can look at digital images from x-ray that are sensational, almost look 3D. We couldn't afford any of that stuff if the dog or the cat wasn't in the bedroom.
Yeah.
So, you know, looking at that as a positive. And then when you get a complaining client, trying to understand, like, we now have a very clear no dickhead policy. Like, if we've got a client who is a DH, we protect our teams and go, I'm really sorry, your behavior is not acceptable.
you're putting me at risk of losing a good team member because of your behavior. You need to go find a vet where this is acceptable, and you probably won't find one. So we'll see you in 6 months when you've done the rounds, got second rate care, and then you come back humble, or you can be humble and go and apologize to that staff member now and save yourself a lot of legwork.
Okay.
And I think it's being that militant, go, that behavior is not acceptable. We're not going to allow that to occur. But then recognizing that generally people who are complaining are only doing it because they perceive that you've dropped the ball, and it's very likely that we have dropped the ball. Somewhere along the line, we've not communicated well, the expectation was different to what we delivered, and getting them to be part of the healing of that process is so powerful. That's what we had a lady who felt like she hadn't been treated well at a particular clinic. I knew that clinic had some customer service issues. So I rang her and talked her through it and said, hey, listen, I'm not going to lie to you. I think that we did drop the ball. Can I get you involved as a secret shopper over the next 3 months? I'll work with that team, and I just want you to go in and see how we're doing. Are we improving it? And then I went to that team and said, listen, we have some customer service issues. I mean, you guys are passionate, but you're seeing the clients as an annoyance. These guys, we have to have that threefold triangle. You have to love the animal, love the client, love your team. If we've got that, then a lot of that stress disappears. Because when they're misbehaving, you see it as passion for good care. So they understood that. I said to them, listen, this lady, I know she's painful, but I'm going to get her to come in as regularly as she can and just measure your customer service. So blow her socks off. Anyway, over the next 3 months, this lady was in and out like a pain to this mob, but she single-handedly helped me get their customer service back to where we wanted to be. She felt part of the process, was now a loyal client and no longer a pain in the ass. So I think it's how we see it. You have to filter, okay, am I tired? Am I tetchy? Am I overreacting to someone? Or can I just drill down and try and understand what the behavior is that's causing this difficulty? But there are just some of us who are not people, and we probably should never have been trained for a people-facing job, but we're too short staffed to throw all those beautiful vets on the scrap heap. We have to just work out ways to communicate. So if I have a vet who is a terrible communicator, we'll try and marry him or her with a nurse that's just a 10 out of 10 human lover, animal lover, communicator. And they work really well. They're constantly pulling that better side and going, hey, you need to soften your delivery, or I understand what you're saying, but you've offended this person. Or they, it's really hard. And my preference obviously would be to have vets and nurses who understand that triangular love in every scenario, but it's not, that's not the real world. We've got to work with the talent we have, and understanding that your vet that hates people might be the most incredible surgeon, or they might be the most incredible medical person. How do we protect them from being client facing enough so that they enjoy their role?
Yeah.
Or for those vets who do find themselves going, I'm nearly over this, how do we sit with them and tease out what they're good at, what they enjoy, and protect them from what they don't enjoy? It, you know, that's, I think, as a team leader, that the continual challenge.
That's awesome. I love that. And you highlight such an important point there, because there is the ideal employee. So the stuff that you talk about, you know, who should we select in that? But then we are also, because if I look at when I had my own practice and I looked at all the leadership and the management training and stuff, a lot of the advice outside of veterinary science is, yeah, pick A players. Pick A players and you won't have any problems. But then I go, well, I just have to pick somebody because there's work to be done. And I can't actually be all that fussy with who I select. So I've got to make it work with the tools I have, or with the things I have available to me, and try and find a way. So I love that approach of yours to say, well, here's the ideal. I want to go back quickly to what you talked about, the selection process. So when you pick your especially the new grads, keeping in mind the resilience stuff and the stuff you're going to do with them, I was going to say to them, but let's say with them. Do you select on that? You talked about the questionnaire that they have at WAGA about checking that you're a balanced person and not just an academic star. Is that part of your selection process, or are you in the same boat of going, well, I've got to take what I can get?
Our selection process for the first year was literally, you know, do you have a pulse and do you wear deodorant? So, literally. And I think most of the vet leaders listening to this will relate, you know, the days of interviewing are long gone. We used to interview, you know, 10 vets for one position. Now you've got one vet for one position and, you know, you interview them and you're like, man, you're a 5 out of 10 on all the areas, but I think I can help you. That's it. And if we look at our first intake, we had 6 graduates. 3 I thought were going to be okay. 3 we were really worried about, but I just needed, it sounds weird, but we needed crash test dummies to test this stuff on. And the weird thing was they did quite well on the resilience development stuff. I remember the guy that set up the ropes course for me to climb this climb called Satan's Smokestack, which is a 40-meter larval tunnel full of spiders, and it's dark, it's claustrophobic, it deals with their fears of heights, fears of confined spaces, fears of spiders and snakes. And they're all in there, and all 6 of them were throwing themselves at that crack like salmon going up a waterfall, to the point where they were bruising themselves. And we're like, whoa, 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 okay, let's get some technique here. And so none of them gave up, but the 3 that got to the top were the 3 that survived the year and are now what I call unicorns. We had 3 resign from the program and leave vet science completely. So this year, for the 6 positions that we had, we interviewed 10, and the difference is huge. Like, we've got, I think, 6 out of 6 might be unicorns this year. It's really positive to, I think the program's getting a bit of momentum. I would love eventually for it to be industry-wide available, where you imagine you do a 5-year course and then you do a 1-year internship focused on resilience, and that 1 year sets you up to be $1 million a year vet. You know, like our absolute unicorn is someone who communicates well, has a love for animals, a love for team, a love for clients. They communicate so well that they're billing in a 38-hour week, $1 million a year. They're getting paid triple figures almost immediately because they're so valuable to the practice. We can build that, but it takes a year intensive to do that. I just don't know that I've got the calories to do it. You know, if you had 6 is exhausting. Mm-hmm. If you had 60, it would be, you'd need another 10 polar survivalists to do it.
I'd love to dig into your program. So first of all, when you talk about all the physical things you make them do, what do the lawyers say about this? What does your HR department say about insurance?
I don't know that we got insurance for this. I'm like, I think having an African background, we're like, hey, let's just do it and ask for forgiveness. But she has dotted the I's and crossed the T's. The liability side was difficult, especially when it comes to climbing on rock or putting people in ice baths. You could have a heart attack or just pushing them. We had them offshore last year on the boat that we used for the polar expedition, sailing from the top of Morton Island in the dark. So they're up all night and they're like, nobody sleeps. The whole idea is you learn how to function, make good decisions without any sleep. Ended up having 30 knots offshore. So the ocean was flat, boats cranked up, and I'm yelling over the wind going, you clip on, you come off this boat, you die. And I'm just looking at these 6 graduates clipped onto the railing, getting wet and cold all night. And to that point, nobody had thanked us for any of the programs to that point. And as we're coming through the heads at 3 o'clock in the morning at Southport there, in my head, I'm going, you know, if we get to the dock and nobody has a word of appreciation, then I'm going to fold this whole program. Like, I just can't put this much calories into this and feel like it's not being appreciated. So we pull out to the dock and all 6 step off on the dock and they're looking up at me as I'm wrapping some rope, getting the boat ready to leave for the night. And they're all 6 personally thank me. And I'm like, are you thankful for what you're learning in the program or are you just thankful for being alive? Like that. I think it was a mix of both. But at that point, I'm like, oh, okay, we're getting somewhere. We've got young kids that everything's happening so fast. You know, they're swiping left, swiping right. They're following people on Instagram or whatever their social media platform. They're jumping out of planes and wingsuiting to another plane and climbing in. You know, life's kind of crazy with what's getting fed into them. So when we're trying to stress them and give them experiences, I think in the virtual world, they've done it all before. It's almost like their nerve endings are burnt. At one point, I said to Andy, our area manager, I said, man, I feel like I could be nude up here with two parrots on my shoulder playing the ukulele, and these grads wouldn't even raise a smile. They're either terrified or they're emotionally dead. There's something not right. And then after that sale night, there was a shift. Everybody started to wake up. And I think it's a combination of just being so terrified in the industry because they've been filled with negativity for 5 years. They come out almost like a dog that's been smacked around the head. It's head shy. It's looking for a fence with the industry. We've set them up to look for the negative things. You know, they, as a boss, you might speak to them a bit harshly or not be as patient or kind as you could be. You might have a long day, and rather than go, hey, that was a long day, they're like, oh, this is what I was warned about. They might have feelings of self-doubt or self-harm, you know, which are a normal transition for anyone. And they suddenly think, this is the industry, it's killing me. So we're just making them so soft and bruised when they come out that they're looking for a fence from the industry. And even the best boss in the world can't fight that. So raising their, what I call their tap out point. Every human being has a tap out point. And we know now that that's teachable. I know my experience with it initially being teachable was when my son-in-law was dating my then 16-year-old number one girl, Jade. He did an adventure with me where we kite surfed from Australia to Papua New Guinea, the first team to do that. And 70 kilometers from the Papua New Guinea coast, he tapped out, said, I can't do this. And I kite surfed back to him and I said, Simon, you got to understand that the human brain has a tap out 30% early. It's a safety feature. It's so that you don't exhaust yourself. It's a survival mechanism. But in this situation, you can learn how to turn that back on, ignore the fuse, and you've got plenty in the tank. You've done 310 kilometers on a kite board. You can do another 70. We'll get you to the beach, put you in a boat, and get you home. And besides, if you want to marry my girl, you're going to get to Papua New Guinea. So anyway, he then, fast forward 5 years, he's my partner on the attempt to cross Greenland south to north. And the record, I think, was held by the Norwegian at 28 days. Over the next 14 days, he showed the most incredible amount of grit and tenacity, and we smashed that record by 14 days, which for Aussies to compete in the Norwegian backyard and smash records just doesn't happen without a huge amount of grit. Not once during that 14 days did he ever look like tapping out. And he led me in. His skills had developed to a point where he was ahead of me on the last drive to a place called Kunnak, the most northern village in the world. And I sat there on the ice with all the huskies at the end of that journey, realizing, okay, we can teach this stuff. Like, this kid tapped out within sight of the end on the Torres journey. 5 years later, he's tougher than any polar explorer I've ever partnered with. How do we instill this in our young ones in the vet industry? And I think it's just that belief, like getting them to understand that it's absolutely fine to have tough days, but when you get knocked down, you know, stay on the mat, breathe a little bit. You're only beaten by it if you don't get back up. And getting them to understand that life is going to knock you down. So, you know, if you're an academic, you've never really had hardship in your life to this point, it's going to be really hard in the veterinary environment because it's a blood sport. So understanding that you're in a blood sport and therefore resilience is necessary is kind of the gateway. Once you realize that, and go, this is the best job in the world, but it is a blood sport. You're going to need some resilience. So getting them to understand that is kind of step one. And our intake this year reflects that, in that we've got a team of six now for the Set for Vet program. They all understand that it's a blood sport. They also all understand it's the best job in the world. But what's sad is my first opening address was the first time in their education that they'd heard anyone refer to veterinary science as the best job in the world. And I'm like, that confuses me. So you've got people teaching you who hate what we do. Like, that's just madness. That is, you know, you've planted a whole bunch of veggies and you're spraying it with Roundup every day, complaining that no veggies are coming up. But what the fuck? Seriously, this is not a common thing.
So why is it the best job in the world to you?
Because we have this rare ability to affect outcomes. You know, if I look at all my medical mates, they're either general practice, anything that comes in, it's generally sniffling noses and whining people. Anything of interest, they refer off to someone else. You know, they're just the catching med, passing off the passes. Or they specialize, and then you're either looking at one body part, you're just doing knee reconstructions, you're just doing hip. It becomes super repetitive. With our industry, in any one day, you could be the marketing expert, you could be the social media manager, you could be the oncologist, you could be the dermatologist, the radiologist. It's exciting, you know, whatever part of the industry that you like. If you like skin, you can start going down that rabbit hole. If you love animal behavior, you know, there's so many streams, so variable, but you have to be looking for the gold in the rock. If you're just looking for the rock, which is what they're all taught to do, and you're being told about the negatives, and nobody's talking about the wonderful things we do. And with the Vet is Life program that I really want to try and fire up this year, that is just refocusing all of our leaders, all of our people speaking in the industry, and getting militant about it. I got so worked up talking to a pharmaceutical group last year that Andy said, "Oh, wow, geez, you're really passionate about this, boss." And I said, "Yeah, I am. Like, we have to be militant. Like, it's the whole, if you don't love it, then F off. Like, why are you in the industry?" I'm so sick of us being quiet when people are being negative. And so much so in clinic. I tried last year a gong in one of the hospitals, and that gong was to be run every time something cool happened. We had stickers all over the gong. New puppy, new client, new kitten. I'm healed. My leg works. You know, all these wonderful things that happen in a day-to-day practice. I was dying, even down to I passed away beautifully. I was managed well. My medical case is going well. All of these things that we could ring the gong for. And what that's doing is just giving voice to the optimists, giving voice to the positive people in the clinic. Because we give voice to the negative people, like the nurse that's grumpy and tired and is just spreading poison through the hospital. We allow her to speak, but the optimists feel silent. So how do we turn up the volume on the optimists? And that's got to happen at clinic level. It's got to happen at a leadership level, all the way through to the ABA, the Veterinary Surgeons Board. All of those guys need to believe that we're doing the best job on the planet. If they don't, then what the F are we doing? Let's get you out of those roles and put someone in who can protect the next 50 years of vets coming through. Because at the moment, they're completely exposed with nothing but poison, vet is death being preached over them. And listen, I'm a realist. I understand there are tough days, but it's not toxic positivity. It's recognizing that there are tough days. If we do the two things, focus on the gold in the rock and build resilience, then we're going to be in a much better position. You and I won't be working so hard over the next couple of decades because you've got good people coming through that are passionate about it and believe that we're making a difference in communities. You know, it's not just the animal we're treating. We're treating the family. You know how many times in consult you're counseling people, you're listening to them. I think of all my favorite clients over the years. They're the ones where we rode through the birth, deaths, marriages with them, you know, whether they're animal deaths or human deaths. You know, we had that relationship whereby we could share that in the consult room, tears in the consult room, hugging, just being open and vulnerable, being human. And you know, that's the very best bit of what we do. I'm passionate about it, as you can tell.
It's interesting because there's a contrast. You say, so there's a vet is life, but then we said in the beginning, but don't expect veterinary science to make you happy. So I'm trying to merge those two concepts. Because how do you put those two side to side?
Yeah, I think that's a shift in attitude, because I think for some time we've been picking people that are already unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
They're already unbalanced. They're already dangerously on the edge, and they're looking for happiness in treating animals. And that's just a lethal cocktail. Like, we honestly, I think what's going to happen for these educators to finally understand what they're doing, they're going to kill a wealthy person's child And then that wealthy person's going to go, hang on a minute, you picked my child who was showing signs of anxiety, self-harm, substance abuse, poor sleep, depression, anxiety. You picked that person for this blood sport, knowing full well the stats, 4 times the national suicide rate, and yet you didn't give a shit enough to tell them this is the wrong industry. It's going to take one of those parents going, no, this is not okay, and then taking the educators to task, but then to finally wake up and go, I know it's easy just to make it a education bar because there's no work involved in filtering out the right people. But when you're essentially killing these kids by picking the wrong people. So what I was saying there is don't come to vet science looking for happiness.
Gotcha.
You have to come with a healthy mindset going, I'm here to serve. Mm. And every vet that I've met with a service mindset is passionate years later. It's a slight shift in approach, but it has a massive change. And then if we then start going, okay, well, let's hashtag vet is life, everything. You have to be that dedicated in understanding it's not really a job per se like anything else. It's, you know what it's like. You're getting your veggies and Mrs. Smith sees you and starts talking about a dog vaginal infection that you treated the week before in the aisle of the supermarket. No human doctor, no dentist, no lawyer is going to get that inappropriate conversation in a supermarket. But because they're animals, people feel it's okay. So it is a lie. Vet is life. You've just got to go, vet is life, laugh it off and go, Mrs. Smith, I'll call you tomorrow. So I think understanding that, you know, don't come to veterinary science looking for a cure. You have to be the cure. But then also understanding that it's a lifestyle. And the more you immerse yourself in that and practice positivity. One thing we're working on this year with our teams is making sure that first thing that comes out of your mouth in the morning is positive. So when you walk into your hospital, you look at your other nurse or your vet and go, yeah, what have you done with your eyes? They look amazing. Or just something positive. Doesn't this hospital smell incredible today? Rather than that, oh man, we've got to walk in, or I went back to back this morning. So it's that negativity coming out of your mouth first thing.
Yeah.
Just being disciplined. It's just like you're doing weights mentally. If you're thinking negative thoughts when you walk into that hospital in the morning, you're going to have a shit day.
It sounds a bit Pollyanna-ish, play the glad game. But what I've learned from other resources in recent years is that concept of neuroplasticity is that your brain takes the shortcuts. It'll take the easy route. Literally, your neurons will fire the ones that get fired most regularly. So if they're the negative ones, that's what's going to happen. And initially, when you start pushing those positive pathways, it might feel unnatural. It might feel fake. You're like, I walk in and I can smell hemorrhagic diarrhea. So that I have my first negative thought. So it takes a bit of effort to look around and go, okay, well, that sucks. But what's good about this morning? Let me go look for it. And once you start identifying it, then it becomes more of a habit. Your brain goes, well, what's good? Before it starts going, well, what's the downside? Because there's always a downside. As you say, it's a blood sport. Something's going to be shitty about your day, probably.
Yeah, you might walk in and it smells like hemorrhagic diarrhea. And you're like, oh, man, that smells bad, but you smell nice. Let's get into this. You know, just looking for a positive and raising it fun. Just go, oh, man, what a start. But I think if we can make that a discipline, then what happens is it becomes cultural to be positive. So when somebody comes in with a negative attitude, they stand out so much. It's like a rock sticking out of, you know, wave crashing on the beach. You're like, that rock wasn't there yesterday. Where's it come from? Let's talk about that. Why is it that you're feeling so negative today? And it's changing that tie, which, you know, I feel for our drug reps because they're going into 8, 9, 10 clinics a day. And you imagine if 10 of them or 8 of them are negative when they walk through the door, nobody wants to see them because they're seen as an imposition on their time.
Mm.
But they are the thermostat. If your drug reps are happy to come into your clinics, they're the best thermostat of how you're doing with the positive speech and positive mindset.
Mm.
You know, like you say, there's definitely a pathway that you can train your brain to do. And the younger we do it, the better it gets. It But, you know, I think it can sound like I'm toxically positive and unaware of the challenges. That's not true at all. I still find days in the vet world tough. It's going, okay, if we do what we do continually and expect a different result, that's crazy. We have to get militant. We have to fight for our industry. If somebody is speaking to you and telling you how crap the industry is, you need to call them out and go, you're a team leader. Why are you speaking like that? All of these young minds are watching you. We're not going to change this through negativity. It's a bit like the climate change crisis. I mean, my whole three expeditions were all exploring how we can explore carbon neutral. And it can be so daunting sometimes going, wow, this is happening so fast. You know, we were parked off the end of PR11 Glacier in Patagonia and watching this massive ice front just falling apart in front of our eyes at a speed. You know, it's one of the fastest degrading glaciers on planet Earth. And we're watching it in real time right in front of us. And then a few months later, I'm at Port Lockroy, the southernmost British Antarctic base. I'm talking to the naturalist there, and he's like, how do you stay optimistic? How do you stay optimistic and not feel depressed with this, the speed that it's changing? We're seeing it in Antarctica so fast. Emperor penguins not able to reproduce because the ice is too thin and the eggs fall through into the water and whole colonies have been wiped out. It's terrifying what's going on there. And I said to him, listen, you do not have a choice. You're a flag bearer and you need to hold the flag. You need to be optimistic. You need to charge forward and believe that mankind will find a solution. For you to get shot, drop the flag and disappear, that's not an option for you. And it's just the same in veterinary science. We've got flag bearers out there who are the optimists who say we can change, we can provide more resilient minds, we can teach them how to be passionate and enjoy every day, teach them how to communicate well, how to build well, how to earn enough funds that you feel blessed. I honestly feel so blessed to be involved in the veterinary industry because of the way that we can build well if we educate our people. We've got nurses now who are millionaires on paper because of their belief in the Vet Love system, and they're now the primary breadwinners in their home. One of my nurses last week said, hey, I never believed I would be the primary breadwinner in our home. My husband's able to pull back because of what we're bringing into the house through dividends. Thank you so much. I said, no, thank you, because you're rewarding me for the belief in the system. The flag bearers need to be out there being optimists. Otherwise, you know, the industry is in real trouble. Similar to the environment story, we have to believe that we're going to find a solution to the carbon issue quicker than we are currently, because currently, you know, it's a very depressing scene out there. So the two mirror each other very well. Your ability to meet people who just bury their head, the Trumpers of the world who are like, no, there's no such thing as climate change. It's a cycle. I'm like, well, you're not looking at the science. Like, we're, as vets, we're scientists, so we understand this. And we've got groups within our industry, like Vets for Climate Action, that are really trying to put a spotlight on this as an industry. Our role now, aside from helping our young ones come through with a good attitude, is to understand how, as an industry, we can move towards being carbon neutral through a recycling, solar power, and planting trees for every surgery. Within VetLab now, we, every time we take a scalpel out of a packet, we're planting two trees up in Borneo, and that's got to be industry standard. Like, we've got to understand, yeah, we're making plastic, yeah, we're making carbon, but we can offset it. And I know that's another whole big discussion.
Yeah, massive.
It really does tie in the whole flag bearer, the whole optimist, the passionate person, vet's life. You're the flag bearer for the industry, and there's a huge responsibility on you. And sometimes as the optimist, it can feel like you're a log in the stream and the whole rest of your team is hanging onto that log and you're getting pulled into the stream. And occasionally I say to our optimists, listen, every now and then you're going to have to shake off like a Labrador and kick all of those people off, go recover, and then hop in the stream and they can all jump on you again. But you only need one optimist in a veterinary team as the flag bearer out the front to completely change the dynamic. So we're not, it's not like we need everyone to be a flag bearer. That'd be chaos.
Yeah.
You need one per team.
Can I briefly circle back to resilience? Because that is your big thing that you talk about.
It's interesting. So you say that, yes, you can develop resilience. So if you have, we have people come through that maybe have been selected for the vet program that don't naturally have it. But are you finding with your program, you can improve it and get better?
I think you can move the needle. Like if you've got someone who's marshmallow material and they're going to tap out, you know, they have one client be rude to them and they're in tears and want to quit the industry, you're not going to turn them into Yoda overnight. But it's moving them to a point where they're safe. But the tap out needs to be well past what normal veterinary life will throw at them. There'll always be those outlier days where they feel challenged and like it's tough, but that happens to the most resilient of us. So we don't have to turn them into Teflon tough. They just need to go from marshmallow to, you know, granite. And then something like that. And we're definitely seeing that, but understanding that the three P's of resilient development are all teachable. If we look at the most important being passion, absolutely. You know, they wouldn't be here. They wouldn't have survived the 5 years generally if they don't have some passion for animal care. So amplifying that and get them to understand that it's a job worth doing. Follow that flag bearer. You know, yeah, you're coming out of the trench, you're getting shot at, but the flag bearer's out the front. Get in behind, slipstream then. Understanding that passion is key. You have to be passionate about what we're doing. And the passion is only possible if they believe their purpose. So, probably the most important P would be purpose. Why are you doing what you're doing every day? You know, people call it the why. I call it the purpose. Why are you getting out of bed? And for me, obviously, my purpose comes in multi-channels. Like if I look at my venture career, it's gone from working how much the human body can endure solo in brutal conditions to now being more, how do we continue to dream and vision and explore, but in a way that's carbon neutral? So that's my purpose on the adventure side. It's morphed now to bringing that purpose back into the veterinary field, where the purpose is to practice veterinary science, build hospitals of excellence with happy teams. That's my purpose on the veterinary side. And then my purpose on the family side is to be the best husband I can be, the best dad I can be, to be present when I'm present, to listen well, you know, so there's multiple channels, but getting these young ones to understand that you've got to have purpose. You've got to understand when you put your boots in the morning, what is it you're going to do? I'm going out there to be a voice for the voiceless. I'm going out there to diminish pain, diminish suffering, to end lives well, and to be, you know, a helpmate for these families. If they believe that, then coupled with passion, they're unstoppable and their resilience will naturally become more hardy without any sort of training once they get those two in line. And then the third P is just that horrible old persistence. You know, we've all been there where you just feel like you're getting knocked under the mat. It's taking a breath, crawling back to your feet and getting them to understand that they're never beaten unless they don't get off the mat. And finding some fun in that, going, man, I got punched three times today by the veterinary game. I had a plating that I did snap and all the screws come out. Guy let the dog jump off a ute. I'm back in there sorting it out. Or I had an upset client because I didn't communicate something well. Those punches in the face are only significant if we let them keep us on the mat. So getting them to understand that persistence underpins their resilience. And if they've got purpose in the morning, passion during the day, and persistence in the afternoon, then they're absolutely set for an incredible life. And vet's life is going to just come out of their pores. And you get a shift in someone like that, then the naysayers around them start to take notice and they become a flag bearer in themselves. Like if I look at the three superstars from the resilience program last year, we've got young vets who are older than them watching them now going, holy crap, these young ones are coming through. If we had vets like this in abundance, then the stress on me and you diminishes, the stress on the industry diminishes, the reps are coming into hospitals thinking, wow, this is blue sky now. The industry is safe. The animals are safe. If we look at where the industry is going with more insurance, people loving their animals even more over the next decade, we're in a good position if we can change this attitude.
Amazing. So I came across two podcasts in the last month or so that had two very conflicting messages about resilience. And I'd love to check your thoughts on it. The one was a doctor who'd written a book about stress and burnout and the good stress and the bad stress. And she talked about a concept called toxic resilience. So she said, well, the whole world's talking about resilience, but for a lot of people, that looks like just keep going, you know, get the grind, get the hustle, go, 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 get up. And it's almost it's that persistent part of it. Just keep getting off the mat. And she had the concept of, no, sometimes resilience means stepping back and recovering. And we talk about that. And then in the same week, I happened to listen to an interview with David Goggins, which I'm sure you'd be familiar with. And I've actually wrote out a quote of something he said. He's all about the stick. He literally says, it's all stick, it's no carrot. And his quote is, he says, I go to these fucking conventions and I look at the audience and these people sign up and they sign up every year and they come to the convention and they're thinking that they're going to learn something different. No, you're just lazy. You know exactly what to do. It just sucks doing it. And I was like, I resonate with both of those, but yeah, what do you think? How do you find the balance between Goggins?
Not being disrespectful to Goggins, but I don't think he probably hasn't been in an environment that's tough enough. If I looked at one of the toughest men in my arena that I've ever seen is a guy called Henry Worsley, who was trying to break my record for the fastest crossing of the Antarctic continent coast to coast through the South Pole at 53 days. The difference being he wasn't using wind power. It was all manpower, which is brutal. So you're pulling the sled. It's a shorter route, but he's pulling the sled from one side of Antarctica. He got to the pole and I had this horrible effect where he had bitten into a Mars bar that had snapped a tooth. He was then taking a lot of pain meds because the tooth was exposed to the temperature as you're breathing in and it's agony. He then burnt a hole in his stomach and pulled the sled for another 7 days before he collapsed. And his last audio transmission is in the words of Shackleton, "My dear, my bolt is shot. I can no longer put one foot in front of the other. I am done." And then literally he collapses, gets picked up and dies on a surgical table in southern Chile. When they opened him up, he had gut content all through his abdomen. He had pulled a sled for 7 days with a ruptured stomach. So, you know, that's Dave Goggins' approach. And in the environments I'm working in, that will kill you. So the veterinary environment is very similar. Like if you ignore those warning signs and don't pull the Maseratis and put them on blocks, let their engines cool down, they're going to do a Henry Worsley every time. So learning from Henry, I know that I have a very good ability to recognize when I'm redlining. And it's easier when I'm traveling solo than when I'm with the team, because I can recognize the Maserati syndrome and go, listen, I'm making incredible mileage here. And on the home run, on my last Antarctic crossing, I was doing an average of about 300 kilometers of ice travel in a day, which is hugely punishing. Like your skis are skipping, they're vibrating, your lower back, your knees, your shoulders, you're connected to a kite for up to 20 hours in a 24-hour day. I started to hallucinate and saw my daughter swimming in a swimming lane next to me. I saw a BWS out there and I saw there's another vet who was at our leaving party with a headband on dancing next to me. And when I saw that, I was like, okay, this is red line fever here. And then you pull yourself aside, get into the tent, eat, double your calories, sleep for 8 hours and bring the temperature down. So I think Dave Gomer's approach does work for less severe scenarios, just harden up muscle through it, but it will lead to death. In a veterinary environment, it'll lead to death. In a polar environment, and I would love to take David Goggins through a 22-hour polar journey. You know, when you're doing 300 kilometers, operating in minus 55 Celsius air temp, and see how he feels about pushing that last little bit, because that will kill you every time. So I think toxic resilience is super dangerous. It's really dangerous for our veterinary industry. It probably has killed some kids over the last decade. But there is an element of just muscle up and do it, but not when you start getting into that red zone.
That's so good. This is your new job, Jeff. We've got to get you and Dave Goggins on an adventure together. This is your life mission.
I would relish that. There's a few other guys I would like to humble.
Have you got time for a quick fire round?
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you listen to podcasts? You said you listened to adventure podcasts when I asked you earlier.
Yeah, absolutely. I listen to, you know, it's funny. My wife has got me into a new one as well. Well, essentially Taylor Swift got Sarah into an NFL podcast called New Heights, two brothers, the Kelce brothers. And then I've got into it for the first time. I watched the Super Bowl this year, and the passion that these guys play with, and share across the New Heights podcast is kind of, you know, in parallel to the passion we have for treating animals on a daily basis and what we need to perform at that highest level. So I've been really enjoying that one. You'll have to, I'll send you links.
The pass along question is where I get my previous guest to ask a question for my next guest, not knowing who the next guest is. And my guest asked a while ago, we talked about it earlier, that change in client expectations and animals becoming more and more part of the family and our level of care going up and up and up and up. Is there a point where it is too much, considering that large parts of the human race don't even have access to quality medical care? When is it too much?
Yeah, that's a tough one, because you look at a feline kidney transplant being possible now. It's kind of ludicrous, because the cat that you're taking out of is going to need that kidney. We know that. So you're creating a problem to fix another one. I think, you know, there's ethical issues there that we know are gray, and I think that's too much. But when it comes down to family willing to put everything on the line for their animal, I think we've got to believe that's okay, A, to do well in the industry, but B, to provide the level of care that people are demanding. They want the same level of care for their pet as they have for themselves medically, which is obviously hard for us to match without a Medicare or Medivet type system. So I don't think we're in danger of ever providing too much care, but then also understanding there's got to be some philanthropy. We've got to play our back some funds into the developing world so that we're not getting that massive gap that, you know, my Labrador gets better treatment than my Afghani child. You know, that's crazy. But there's always been that stretch, I suppose, between First Nation and, you know, developing nation.
Have you got a question for my next guest?
Yeah, if you imagine the worst day you had in veterinary science, what was it that got you back off the mat?
Fantastic. I look forward to the answer to that. And then the last one, and I feel like this whole episode was kind of that, but maybe we can wrap up with one message. So you have an opportunity to speak to not just your chosen few in VetLove, but to all of the new vet grads of the world. And they say, Jeff, you've got a couple of minutes. Tell them one little thing. What's your one message to them?
I think as a new grad coming in, you need to look in the mirror and just say to yourself, you are effing amazing, because you've prospered and persevered, get through to this point where you're now able to be a carer for these incredible animals. You're able to make a difference for these families. You're able to be a positive voice in a pretty sick industry at the moment. We need flag bearers out there. So don't accept anyone telling you this is the worst job in the world. You're not going to harm yourself. We're going to protect you from that. You can do really well if you learn how to communicate and bill for your time properly. You can do exceptionally well, as well as the dentists, easily. And you don't have to work all hours and self-harm and be depressed and substance abuse and not sleep. All of that stuff is unnecessary. We can protect you from that. If you've got someone around you being negative, then get the hell out of there. Protect yourself. It's almost like an abuse situation. If you feel like you're not safe and not protected and you don't have positive people around you, then move. Don't let that mold, don't let that poison get into your system. I'm militant about that. Just protect yourself. That first 2 years of your career is going to set you up. I've never found anyone working in a negative environment in that first 2 years prosper. You know, it's very hard to change your mindset. That neuroplasticity is limited. You're going to get it set. If you're in a positive, dynamic, fun, happy environment, you better do well. If you're in the opposite of that, then move fast.
I like that. We're freaking amazing. We're freaking amazing, and be the flag bearer.
Yeah.
That was so epic. I thought we were going to talk about adventure stuff. We didn't even get to that. I'm going to have to get you back on or at least meet you for a beer somewhere and get some stories. Jeff, thank you. That was really spectacular. I think it's going to mean a lot. I can't wait to get this out there. Thank you for your time here, and thank you for what you're trying to do in the profession and globally. You've got a lot of things that you do. You're tackling global warming and adventuring. So the fact that you still commit so much love and passion to the vet profession is amazing. And thank you for doing that.
Thank you, Hugh. Thanks so much for having me on. It's fun.
Before you disappear, I wanted to tell you about our new weekly newsletter. I speak to so many interesting people and learn so many new things while making the podcast. So I thought I'd create a little summary each week of the stuff that stood out for me. We call it the Vet Vault 321, and it consists of, firstly, three clinical pearls. These are three things that I've taken away from the clinical podcast episodes. My light bulb moments, the penny dropping, any new facts, and the stuff that we need to know to make all the other pieces fit. Then, two other things. These could be quotes, links, movies, books, a podcast highlight, anything that I've come across outside of clinical vetting that I think you might find interesting. And then, one thing to think about. I'll share something that I'm pondering, usually based on something that I've read or heard, but sometimes it'll be just my own musings or rants. The goal of this format is that you can spend just 2 to 3 minutes on the clinical stuff and move right along if that's all that you're after. But if you're looking for content that is more nourishing than cat videos or doom scrolling, then our two other things should send you in the right direction. And then something extra for when you feel like a slightly longer read. If you'd like to get these in your inbox each week, then subscribe by following the newsletter link in the show description wherever you're listening to this. It's free, I think it's useful, it's fun, and it's easy to unsubscribe if it's not for you. Okay, we'll see you next time.